This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 158.
One of the things that connects anybody who drives disruptive change is they're questioning the status quo. They're saying, why are we doing it this way? How might we do it differently? What about? Those are the sorts of questions they ask very naturally. So you want to make sure that your environment supports people who will ask questions like that. Because if you don't have space for people who will provoke, people who will ask the tough question, people who will say, well, we might be able to find a different way to do this, then you're never going to get the benefit of disruptive growth. And of course, given the way the world is changing, it is critically important that you have an environment that's hospitable to people who are looking at the world that way. Second thing I will say, there is also lots of room for people who are not questioning the status quo, who are there to help, to augment, to say, well, let me go and solve this particular piece of the problem or give you this piece of the puzzle that you haven't been thinking about before. None of this, I said it before, I'll say it again, is done by an individual. It's a collectively individualistic activity. So yes, you need to have room for the misfits and the visionaries and all that, and also have room for everybody else who's going to make ideas a reality. It takes all of it.
How can HR leaders embrace disruption to drive innovation? Why should your organization disrupt itself? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Since launching the Future of HR podcast in late 2022, I've been fortunate to have meaningful conversations with over 150 HR thought leaders and world-class CHROs from around the globe. These conversations have given me a unique perspective on where HR is today and where we're heading in the future. And because of this vantage point, over the past year, I have had the privilege and opportunity to be a keynote speaker at 16 internal HR conferences for Fortune 500 companies like Kohler, AbbVie, Corning, Nike, LabCorp, and more. And what am I talking about? More often than not, I'm asked to give my signature talk, Future-Proofing HR, Creating Value by Unlocking the Capabilities of Tomorrow, which is designed to help your HR team shift their mindset from being a strategic business partner to a value creator. And these aren't just presentations, they're interactive sessions that equip your HR leaders with practical frameworks to challenge conventional thinking and move beyond the traditional HR playbook. If you're planning your next HR conference, career week, or leadership gathering and want to provide your team with insights that drive immediate impact, I'd love to connect and explore how I might help make your event a big success. Feel free to reach out to me at jp@futureofhr.com to start the conversation. My guest this week is Scott Anthony. Scott is a clinical professor of strategy at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business and a senior advisor at Innosight, where he helped the company triple revenue before its successful acquisition. He's an internationally recognized expert on navigating disruptive change, who has been named one of the world's most influential management thinkers multiple times by Thinkers 50. Starting his career under Clay Christensen, the legend in disruptive innovation, Scott has spent over two decades helping major organizations navigate strategic transformation. He teaches cutting-edge courses like Leading Disruptive Change and AI and Consultative Decision-Making. And this is Scott's second time on the podcast, as he was on episode 110, where he talked about creating the culture of innovation. But this time he's back to talk about the insights from his ninth book, Epic Disruptions, 11 Innovations That Shaped Our Modern World. This might be his best book yet, and I really enjoyed the conversation as we discussed the four critical questions every leader must answer about disruption, why disruption casts three dangerous shadows and how HR can address each one, why organizations unintentionally accelerate technologies that threaten their own existence, why the right strategic choices during disruption often look and feel completely wrong at first, and what HR leaders can learn from Florence Nightingale, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Scott. Scott, welcome back to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
No, I'm doing great, JP. It's great to be with you again.
Yeah, it is great to be back. This is your ninth book, but it's really, I guess, one of the first ones you've written on your own. Congrats on that. That's amazing to write nine books or be a part of nine books. And this one, I have a feeling it's going to be your best one yet.
I certainly hope so. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to getting into the discussion around it.
Well, absolutely. And as you start Epic Disruptions, you talk about these four questions you're trying to answer, which I thought were really brilliant. But tell us more about these four questions and how they led you on the journey to write this book.
Anyone who knows me knows that disruption has been my obsession for 25 years now, since I met Clayton Christensen at the Harvard Business School in 2000. And despite that obsession, despite all the work I've done with it, there still are questions bouncing around my head. The four that I interrogate in the book, number one, who does it? Who actually drives disruptive innovation? My answer is that every disruptive story has heroes in it, and that's plural. There's no lone genius. There's no individual inventor. It always takes a team to go and do it. Question two, is it predictable? There's been a lot of research around disruption since Clayton Christensen discovered the phenomena in his doctoral research, a lot of decoding of disruption. My conclusion is it's predictably unpredictable. There are patterns, but there are twists and turns on the path to success. Question three, is it accelerating? It certainly feels like it. It feels like we're in an era where things happen like this. My conclusion is yes, it's happening faster than it did before, but it still requires patient perseverance, often over long periods of time. And then the final question, is it a universal good? I think there's a general perspective that innovation is a good thing, that disruption drives performance, and I agree with that. But the more deeply you study the history of disruption, the more clearly you see its shadow. So yes, it is a good thing, but it's not a universal good. It's good for some, bad for others. And the middle of a disruptive change can be really messy. And I'm sure we'll explore all of these topics as we keep going through our discussion.
That's a great summary. I do think people need to read the book because there's so many great stories in here that I had not seen before. And I was telling you that it's a book that I really feel like you guys spend some time with, but you can learn so much, especially from a business perspective. And now one of the things you talked about is, and you say in the book, is that disruption is the engine of progress. So disruption is the engine of progress. But for many people, like you said, that messy middle can feel like anything but progress. For HR leaders listening, like how should they think about disruption and how it can move us forward?
This is a great question and a great topic, and we could explore a lot of different avenues related to it. I want to really focus for a minute on the downside of disruption, because of course, there's a lot of good in it. But the question that you've asked really goes to what are some of the things that HR leaders need to be worried about? I said the idea that there is a downside that disruption casts a shadow in the previous question. I want to just go a little bit deeper in it. When disruption comes, there are three primary issues that you need to be aware of. Number one, disruption will change power dynamics inside organizations. Disruption's all about competing in different ways, taking things that were expensive and making them affordable, taking things that were complicated and making them simple. That means power is often going from centralized to decentralized locations. You could have one business unit win and another business unit lose. You have to be really aware of how those power dynamics are changing. Shadow number two, as individuals, we all struggle with what's known as the status quo bias. All things being equal, we would like things to stay exactly the way they are. Remember, the first time you went into an Uber or used an Airbnb or opened up ChatGPT, if you're a normal human being, there's a little intimidation when you do that. And when you're in a world of ever-present disruption, it's almost scary to wake up in the morning because everything is changing. So you as an HR leader have to help people with that. And then the final challenge, if you're inside an organization that is going through a transformational change precipitated by disruption, as many organizations are today, you have to recognize that many of your people will struggle with an identity crisis. They went to work for a particular company that did a particular thing. They associate with that. That becomes their identity. As the organization goes from to, that association breaks. Individuals then lose their sense of being, And that can be really disconcerting for them. So again, as an HR leader, you have to help people find things to hold on to through the change. A lot in this that we can go into more deeply, but those are some of the downsides, some of the things in disruption shadow that you really have to be aware of.
Really insightful. And I think that identity piece is critical because especially now in the age of AI, and AGI being such a disruptive technology that will likely impact everyone's job in some way. The question for me has been really saying, how do we think about how we add value and how that's going to change? And we have to be agile to that. But that isn't easy to do. It's easier to say that than actually to say, hey, 50% of my job just shifted completely. I don't have a role the way I used to do something, right? So I think that disruption piece is big. And so the identity piece is something I hadn't really thought about in that way.
Well, if I just pause at this for a second, just talk about it from just a human angle, I look at myself. One of the ways that I distinguished myself throughout my career is I was never the best writer, but I was usually one of the fastest ones. I was really good, tracing back to my days as a college journalist, putting out the first draft of something. And that used to be an unusual and valuable skill. And now it's completely useless because I'm fast, but not as fast as ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini or whatever. So what do I have to do? I have to be unique. That means doing fewer, better, deeper sorts of things because that's the only way in which I can compete. It's a little bit of an identity crisis for me because speed was my hallmark and that's gone now. I'm still smiling because there's plenty of other things I can do, but I have to be aware of it and there's a loss that comes along with it.
It's really helpful to think about that. Thank you for sharing that. I'm not surprised you were a journalist, actually. That kind of makes sense that you've been able to really piece together these amazing stories as well because I think that is a skill set in itself. Now, I'm not sure AI could completely replicate the exact same way, the same kind of area. But you're right. The idea of us disrupting ourselves, disrupt our companies being disrupted, you know, how do we get comfortable with disruption at that personal level? And saying that we say too much, get comfortable being uncomfortable, but that is a skill set in itself that I think you can learn over time, but it's not easy. So I think it's going to be interesting. So from an HR perspective, we got to think about this from that people perspective that you said. Now, one fascinating insight from your book is that companies often play a pivotal role in developing the very innovations that actually disrupt them. Tell us more about this pattern and what organizations can do about it.
The first place that I observed the pattern in the book goes back to 1440. So the book is a deep historical book. The first chapter focuses on gunpowder, which starts in the year 132. Second chapter is then the printing press. And 1440 is the year that Gutenberg and team really come up with the essence of the printing press. Who's the first customer of the printing press? Well, it's the Catholic Church. No big surprise. They have these Bibles that are more than 1,000 pages, which means it takes 2 or 3 years to create one if you've got a scribe doing it by hand. So a technology that enables you to mass produce Bibles looks like a gift from, pardon the pun, God at first. But it also allows people like Martin Luther to spread very different views on the way that religion ought to be organized. So the Catholic Church helps the technology to get off the ground and then watches in horror as you have the Reformation and lots of religious changes in the centuries ahead. I think you're seeing, by the way, the same thing today. There's a lot of consulting companies that are really prospering, helping clients adopt AI that feels really good in the short term. But in the medium or longer term, I wonder if they aren't putting themselves out of jobs. So, you know, the thing you want to be thinking about is, are you unintentionally hastening something that will cause your demise? And if that's true, what's the next thing that you're going to do? Because change is inevitable. You're not going to stop it. But if you're seeing something that's going to lead to big changes in and around your space, you got to get ahead of it.
Really interesting. From an HR leader or even business leader perspective, you're thinking about kind of these innovative companies, right? The innovator's dilemma, right? A lot of times it's the point of status quo. Things are great. We've got good margins. We've got a good market. We see something like an AI or other innovations coming along, but they're too small to really bother us, right? They're kind of that gnat we've moved away. But over time, that trend grows. And at some point, sometimes people make investments in those small companies that then almost can eat the bigger company. Maybe you've seen situations like that. Maybe a more recent example, Scott?
For sure. I think a really good example of this is what Apple did over the previous 2 decades. It would have been very easy after Apple pioneered the iPod and created essentially an entirely new category of music players for it to say, this is a big growth business. We've got our computing business. Let's just go and maximize these things. A phone. the idea of essentially putting a computer in everyone's pocket, that's weird and different. That, in fact, goes against Clayton Christensen's original research that says the market leaders do not invest in technologies that are disruptive. The smartphone, very clearly disruptive compared to a personal computer. In the early days, not as much performance, but brings computing to a completely different context. Apple, of course, invests in the technology. It is not an overnight success. We forget this when we look at the iPhone story, but it really took a couple of years before it took off. In the early days, the iPhone was a limited product. There was no app store. In fact, Steve Jobs didn't want an app store at first. He said the killer app for the iPhone was the ability to make and receive phone calls. We forget all these things over time. But once Apple added the App Store, once it went to next generation wireless technologies, it really began to take off. And some call it now the most successful product in consumer history. But in the early days, it's not clear. You have to fight against yourself to do it. And you then have to go through that period of time where it takes time to really figure out the model that's going to scale. This is true for everything. Microsoft and AI right now, some of the companies that are investing in autonomous vehicles, in ride sharing, or in the automotive space, they all have to deal with the same basic problem that success doesn't happen overnight. You need to use patterns, models, intuition to say, this is one of those that's going to succeed. And be willing, as Jeff Bezos said, to be misunderstood for long periods of time. None of this is easy.
That's a great example. I think we all have forgotten about the iPhone for sure, because BlackBerry was actually the most popular phone, I believe, when it first came out. People still love the BlackBerry. It took a while for people to understand the power of the iPhone. To your point, the Apple, you get to correct me if I'm wrong, the iPod was when they really got rid of the iPod and put phone on the music on your phone. I mean, they were really cannibalizing, which was a great business at the time, this MP3 player, which has gone away. And that is like a relic, but it was a really successful product. And most companies would have wanted to have, well, we've got our MP3, here's our phone, right? They wouldn't have want to keep them separate, right? To keep those cash cows going.
Absolutely. And two, again, Apple did it when it launched the iPad. I remember Tim Cook, when the iPad launched and was a seemingly overnight success story, going to $10 billion in sales within 18 months, someone asked about cannibalization. And he said, sure, at the margin, I'm sure we've had some cannibalization. But if this is what cannibalization feels like, it feels pretty good. And this is what disruption does. The net result of disruption is almost always new growth. When you make it simple, you make it affordable, you make it accessible, you expand markets. Of course, there's going to be some change at the margin, but if you can really embrace the disruptive power of simplicity, affordability, accessibility, the net result is going to be powerful growth.
Does that explain a little bit around what's happening to AI and ChatGPT, initially at least?
It's a really interesting one. I think we have to, as we look at something like ChatGPT, we have to be very aware of the context we're in. We're both in the United States. We have a developed education infrastructure. We've got a developed healthcare infrastructure. There's information everywhere. We're still finding really interesting, really novel uses for the technology. But now plant yourself in a country that doesn't have education, that doesn't have healthcare, that doesn't have advisors for wealth, and on and on and on. And you can then truly understand the disruptive potential of generative AI, because what you're in those contexts providing is something when people had nothing. And competing against non-consumption has always been a really powerful way to grow. So in our world, the world you and I live in, ChatGPT is augmenting, filling in cracks, and so on. In many other parts of the world, it's creating completely new applications, ecosystems, ways of interacting, and so on.
That's what I was reading, that it was like in India and China, the usage by people there in terms of ChatGPT, percentage of population was very, very high compared to the US, a lot higher, and actually more positively viewed as well. So, I mean, it's a really great point to think about this. You also talk about the right choices can often look like the wrong ones, but we all look at the right choices and it often looks like the wrong ones when disruption strikes. Give us an example of where investing in something that seems counterintuitive turned into be a really smart move.
We could dwell on Apple longer if we wanted to, about how the investment, as we just talked about in the iPhone and other platforms, might not have been completely intuitive. But I want to highlight a different piece of the iPhone. Just stick with that story for a little bit. In the early 1950s, there is a lab project that goes wrong in Corning, a big glass company. The lab project that goes wrong leads to an accidental discovery, a new material that can withstand tremendous heat and still retain many of the properties of glass. Corning takes it and commercializes it in a line of kitchenware and then tries to make it transparent so they actually can find places where it can replace glass. They try, they succeed, they make it transparent, but they can't make it thin. So they take this project, they call it Project Muscle. They invest $300 million in today's terms. They try and create a commercial application for it. They come up with windshields for cars. Problem, the substance is 14 times stronger than glass. When they run the test with crash test dummies, the crash test dummies don't survive hitting the glass. So they say, okay, this is not a market for this product. We can't find anything else. We're going to shut it down. Now, usually when you shut something down, you say that's done and that's the right thing to do. The wrong thing to do is to go and continue to tinker with it. Well, Corning continued to tinker with it, continued to play, continued to experiment with making it thinner. Lo and behold, a new application emerges 35 years after the project had been shut down, a screen for a cell phone. It starts out small in the Motorola Razr flip phone. And then in 2007, Steve Jobs is looking for something to replace the shambly plastic that was on the phone. He goes to Corning. He tells Wendell Weeks, the CEO, I've heard you've got this thing that's really thin, that's really pretty glass. Can you do it in 6 months at scale? And Wendell Weeks said, we can do it, not in 6 months, not at scale. And Steve Jobs' famous reality distortion field said, yes, you can, you will do it. And lo and behold, Corning did. That's Gorilla Glass. It's now in 8 billion devices around the world. There's a bunch of things that look like the wrong choices here, continuing to have an underground project tinkered with, trying to force something before its time. But when you get the right ingredients together, really magical things can happen.
It's a great story. Corning's an amazing company. Actually, Corning CHRO, Jordana Kummerud, has been on the podcast. So I'm a fan of that organization. All right, next question for you, because I mean, we want to cover a lot of the book. There's a whole section on Florence Nightingale launching three distinct disruptions, which I was not aware of any of these, and I thought was fascinating. So I wanted to let the HR leaders hear a little more about this, but talk more about what we can learn from how she approached transforming systems.
Great question. And Florence Nightingale, you know, there's 11 stories in the book. They're all my favorite to a degree, but Florence Nightingale is definitely above the average line. I really like the way that chapter came together. So first, the very brief story of Florence Nightingale. Florence Nightingale gets called by God to become a nurse, not an obvious thing for her to do. At the time, it was a lower class profession. Her parents were against it, but she was very dogmatic. She goes and gets trained. She starts doing things in a hospital in London. And then she gets called to go in the Crimean War to go work in a hospital. What she learns in the war is that the worst place to be in war is not on the battlefield. It's actually in the hospital because the conditions were so squalid that people were dying of infectious diseases. They ultimately get a team from London in to go and improve the hygiene of the hospital, and the deaths in the hospital go way down. She goes back to England. She's become a social media star of the day, the lady with the lamp and all that. And she's then trying to figure out, what do we do to drive better hygiene habits? What do we do to make sure this doesn't repeat? She has three different disruptions. First, she disrupts with data visualization. She came up with a range of very powerful visualizations working with William Farr from the Statistical Society that showed how bad the conditions in the Scutari Hospital were. Number two, she wrote books, Notes on Nursing, aimed at the layperson so they could understand how to go and practice good nursing habits wherever they were. Number three, she taught, created and then spread Nightingale nurses throughout the entire world, the first hospital in King's Cross in London. The connected tissue between all of these things is trying to find simple ways to enable broader populations to be able to do the basics that don't treat people when they get sick, but prevent people from getting sick in the first place. One of the really powerful lessons you see in the Florence Nightingale story is disruption in healthcare is about letting lesser skilled practitioners do more things, making care more accessible, making care more affordable. Those visualizations she did led to major reforms that led to things that we take for granted today, sewage systems, clean water, and so on. A really powerful force that drove huge change in healthcare in England and throughout the world.
It's an amazing story, and you're so good at telling these stories, and they're really complex in very simple ways. But I love the idea, if you think about it from an HR perspective, trying to get change. One, you have to have a visual way to see there's a problem and measure it. And so the idea of being able to see what was happening with that visual dashboard is huge. Number two, writing a book so people could understand things in a more common way. So whether it's like SOPs or protocols, or you know, using Loom videos today to say, hey, here's how you might do something that makes it more easy, helps get more people involved. And then I love how she kind of really just duplicated herself by training, educating, and really bringing more people along on that journey, kind of a typical classic change. You get more champions that can go out and send that message out and bring that to the world. Did I miss anything, Scott, and how you think about this from a change perspective?
I wish I had given as eloquent an answer as you just did. I think that's beautiful. One thing I would just add, there was a great academic article that I read about the visualization she had. And the visualization is very unusual. It's a polar area chart, which I've never seen before. You Google it, you can go and see it. Look for Nightingale Polar Area Chart. But the academic review of it said it is an interocular visualization. Interocular, it hits you between the eyes. Once you see it, and it takes a minute, you got to do some work, you can't unsee it. And that idea of how do we make the case for change in a really powerful, unforgettable way is a really important part of the story.
Well, hopefully people will be Googling that after the podcast. I'll try to find it and put it in the show notes. That's a good one. You also talk a little bit about, and you mentioned that market-leading incumbents face specific challenges when investing in AI. Tell us more about these challenges and what advice you have to CEOs at established companies who are trying to integrate AI thoughtfully.
Well, I think, JP, it really goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the discussion, the idea that one of the things that people naturally resist is change that threatens their identity. And AI is really interesting. So a couple years ago, I started teaching a class up at Tuck called Generative AI and Consultative Decision Making. The idea is about half of our graduates go into consulting. There's this new tool. So let's practice in the safe environment of the classroom how to use AI to augment our ability to advise on decisions as consultants. The thing that really struck me is how scared students were. These are people who are in an MBA program taking a class that is credit, no credit, and it's almost impossible not to get credit, where there's no repercussions of screwing up, and still, they were nervous about it. And I think the root of it is because AI appears to be so human, it threatens who we are as humans. So I think one of the biggest things organizations need to do is counter fear with fun. Try to make it enjoyable for people to use new technologies like AI. Don't make it work. Don't make it something where people feel like it's a forced march. Ethan Mollick from the University of Pennsylvania says the price of admission for AI is three sleepless nights where you're just screwing around with it. It's games, coming up with stories for your kids, et cetera, et cetera. The idea of letting people muck around, play and have fun, I think is critically important if people are going to get AI adoption to go up. Otherwise, people are going to, I think, be held back because of their fear.
Well, that's a really interesting point. And I think Andrew Ng said this, you don't need to be an AI expert, you need to be an AI explorer, which I think makes a lot of sense in that same line of just go out and have fun with it, because especially on your own time. But I think it does require outside of work to really get comfortable with AI, from my perspective. But there's some real fear there. We have to acknowledge that automation has killed jobs in the past. Doesn't typically kill work. Work, we've seen as humans, are really good at finding new ways to create work, but it will take some tasks away. So it's going to be interesting to see. Now, the other thing I was going to ask you about, Scott, is you talk a lot about in the book, Renaissance era scientists, corporate visionaries, rebels, misfits. These are not typically the people who get hired into big corporations. What should HR be thinking about, whether we're nurturing or hiring, selecting talent that have this epic disruption capability?
Well, let me say two things about this. First, one of the things that connects anybody who drives disruptive change is they're questioning the status quo. They're saying, why are we doing it this way? How might we do it differently? What about? Those are the sorts of questions they ask very naturally. So you want to make sure that your environment supports people who will ask questions like that. Is if you don't have space for people who will provoke, people who will ask the tough question, people who will say, well, we might be able to find a different way to do this, then you're never going to get the benefit of disruptive growth. And of course, given the way the world is changing, it is critically important that you have an environment that's hospitable to people who are looking at the world that way. Second thing I will say, there is also lots of room for people who are not questioning the status quo, who are there to help, to augment, to say, well, let me go and solve this particular piece of the problem or give you this piece of the puzzle that you haven't been thinking about before. None of this, I said it before, I'll say it again, is done by an individual. It's a collectively individualistic activity. Individuals do things, individuals provoke, individuals prompt, but ultimately the collective is required if you're going to do things in different ways. If we go back to the printing press for a minute, yes, of course, we remember Gutenberg, but he had a whole team he was working with. And if there wasn't Konrad Saspach, who had the printing press, if there wasn't Johann Fust, who provided the funding, if there wasn't the cardinal that said, I will buy your product, none of it would have happened. So yes, you need to have room for the misfits and the visionaries and all that, and also have room for everybody else who's going to make ideas a reality. It takes all of it.
That's a great message. It really helps to understand. Because I do think sometimes organizations can not want to hire or sometimes push out people who are misfits and they go start other companies. And there's a lot of stories of that happening. But I think to your point, just realizing that it takes all. We need everyone. We need some people challenging the status quo. Some people who are going to help us build up a new status quo is just as important.
Right. If I can say just one more thing about this, JP, just because I do have a copy of the book next to me, and there's a quote that's going through my head that I had the page marked. Page 24, we're talking about the people who drove gunpowder, which is the first case in the book. And there is this great quote from a book that I read about the history of gunpowder. The craft attracted adherents across Europe, alchemists, blacksmiths, enterprising peasants, men fascinated by the unknown or intrigued by the commercial potential, daredevils, visionaries, madmen. So you can see lots of different people involved. Some found in the profession not fortune, but disfiguring burns and death. The grinding of gunpowder was ever a perilous craft. Now, the burns that people suffer when they try and drive disruption inside organizations, thankfully, are metaphorical today, but they still are very real. So another thing that the HR leaders have to do is make sure when the experiment doesn't work, when the prototype misfires, when something bad happens, when a hypothesis is proved wrong, it isn't something that is a career-threatening event for the people who are pushing the frontier. They need to make sure that those people are seen, that they're celebrated, that they give them a high five, they give them a hug, whatever is socially appropriate, because those things really matter if you're trying to encourage the pursuit of disruption.
And that is why I love you on this podcast, because that is a great analogy with the gunpowder. And I think just getting that scarred or burnt that can happen if you try to innovate or be an entrepreneur inside a company. That's a really great, great warning, Scott. Thanks for pointing that out. Last question for you around the book is, given everything you've learned about studying these epic disruptions, what's the single most important mindset shift that HR leaders need to make right now?
It goes back to what Clay did with the language related to disruption. So if you go back and look at Clay's original doctoral thesis in the first articles, it was disruptive technology. And we were obsessed with the technology and the bells and the whistles and what it could and couldn't do. And somewhere along the line, he said, no, technology isn't quite right because it's not the technology that's hard. It's the business model. It's the operating model and so on. So we called it disruptive innovation instead. And innovation just has a more humanistic feel to it than technology does. And I think within that is a very recurrent message that this is not done by companies. It is done by people. So there's a story in the book about Procter & Gamble creating Pampers. Procter & Gamble didn't do anything. Procter & Gamble's nothing. What happened was a leader named Vic Mills appointed a person named Bob Duncan, who led a team that included Harry Tecklenburg and lots of other people. They're the people who did something. So you have to recognize that all of this work is done by humans, which means HR is truly an indispensable partner accelerator of innovation. Because if you don't have the right humans doing the right things, nothing else matters.
Well, Scott, I was going to ask you my famous question, which is, what's one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR? But I feel like you may have just answered that again.
I could pick humans. I could pick disruption. I still will stick with the idea of adaptive capacity above all of this. I think one of the big changes that has happened over the past 30 years, when Clay goes and invents the idea of disruption, it's a narrow idea that applies to a very small segment of the economy. Today, Alex Partners says 70% of leaders say they're facing imminent disruption. So it's every nook and cranny of the global economy. That means it's not about responding once to. It's about having the capacity and the ability to constantly adapt and evolve. It's really building an organizational capability to consistently change, be comfortable with being uncomfortable, and so on. So to me, adaptive capacity is really the name of the game going forward.
Scott, this was a pleasure. The book is Epic Disruptions. Go out and buy it. You guys will not be disappointed. Thanks so much again for being on the podcast.
JP, the pleasure is mine.
Thanks again to Scott for sharing his insights and practical advice from his new book, Epic Disruptions. As you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and your business impact. So go to futureofhr.com and subscribe, and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from HR thought leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with another amazing guest, Mita Malik. Mita is a Wall Street Journal best-selling author of Reimagine Inclusion, and she's on a mission to make our workplaces more inclusive. Mita is not only a change maker with a track record of transforming culture and business, I consider her a friend. And she's back in the podcast for a second time to talk about her new book, The Devil Emails at Midnight, What Good Leaders Can Learn from Bad Bosses. This is a powerful book full of real stories that we can all relate to. And we had a lot of fun in this episode, and I don't think you'll want to miss it. Thanks again for being part of the Future of HR community.